Do you want more energy, better sleep, and better health? Who wouldn't? Get a free Scalar Light no obligation 15-day trial at scalarlight.com.
Hello and welcome to the Brain Health and Beyond Show with your hosts, Aisha and Dean Sherzai. Join us in this session as we discuss the amazing new research shared at the recent Alzheimer's Association International Conference. We will discuss the research highlighting the effects of socio-demographic factors and different lifestyle factors on the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease and how to avoid it.
We're excited to talk to you about these amazing research that's coming out in the last few years, and I think we're having a game-changing, paradigm-shifting moment that we've been speaking about for the last few years, but now it's really coming to fruition.
Absolutely. Here, so. Today we're going to go over some of the very interesting papers that were published earlier this year in the Alzheimer's Association International Conference, which took place in Los Angeles.
Now, we have to give you a little context. We've been in these conferences for many, many years.
That's right.
And every time we used to go, there was the same concept over and over again.
Yeah.
The amyloid, the tau, the molecular, the animal models. But it was about time that this paradigm, that perspective changed. And we were sensing this over the last few years. In fact, 3 years ago, when we went, it was the first series of papers around lifestyle and its influence on dementia. Because up to now, there was almost a resistance to the idea that pills are not going to solve everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then a year ago, 30% influence, then 40%. And this year, the majority of the conference was the hot topic was about lifestyle and its profound effect on brain health.
Absolutely.
And Alzheimer's in particular. So with that context, we wanted to go over actually just a few of the papers because there were so many papers, so many research projects that it was actually overwhelming, and we wouldn't have enough time. If we had even 10 hours, we wouldn't have enough time to go over everything thoroughly.
That's right.
We're going to go over about 13 papers. They're really the exciting ones that stand out.
Well, let's start with this one. The first one is about the impact of healthy lifestyle factors on the risk of Alzheimer's dementia. And this study was done by Rush University in Chicago. And it was a very interesting study. Rush University has taken charge of looking at epidemiological patterns of lifestyle and how it affects it, and they have this wonderful population. And so this one looked at various healthy lifestyle factors, so diet and exercise and stress management, and how it individually contributed to lower risk of Alzheimer's dementia.
Rush University has always been a lead when it came to lifestyle.
That's right.
And now they're really becoming the centerpiece of a lot of the work.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And so this was based on the Chicago Health and Aging Project.
Correct.
And they followed up their population for about 9 years. And they looked at people who developed Alzheimer's disease in two populations. So the first one was the Rush Memory and Aging Project, and then the Chicago Health and Aging Project. And they found out that in a model where they put a lot of variables in it, each additional lifestyle factor, whether it was a healthy diet or exercise or stress management, lowered the risk of Alzheimer's disease in that population. And the numbers are amazing. So they said that compared to people who had, say, none of these healthy lifestyle risk factors or maybe one of them, those who had two or three lifestyle risk factors, their dementia went down to 39%.
Correct.
So they had 39% lower risk of developing Alzheimer's disease compared to those who didn't have any or maybe one healthy lifestyle factor. And then compared to these individuals, those who had more healthy lifestyle, such as, you know, more better diets and better exercise patterns, and in this model, they said in those with four or five low-risk lifestyle factors, the incidence of Alzheimer's disease went down by 59%.
Yes.
So there was a 59% lower risk of developing Alzheimer's disease with healthy lifestyle.
Correct.
We've never heard that before. And I think this was the paper that just blew up in social media and everybody was talking about it. It's 59 point something percent. So essentially 60% lowering the risk of Alzheimer's disease by lifestyle alone.
Now, let's give context to this. When we came out with our book and we talked about lifestyle, we said as much as 90% if it started earlier and if it's massively comprehensive. Now, the variables that they looked at were not the comprehensive approach that we're talking about.
Right.
We're talking about a life of whole food, plant-based.
Right.
As true as possible.
Absolutely.
As close as possible.
Absolutely.
Intensive exercise, stress management, sleep hygiene and sleep, you know, restorative sleep. And mental activity, significant mental activity. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about the effect of cognitive reserve and mental activity on health. We're talking about the disparities as far as women is concerned and racial. And in fact, the main component of that is lifestyle. And we'll tell you what each of those lifestyle really mean in your life. If you're a woman, if you're a minority of the minority populations, or you know, if you have multiple people in your family, where the effect of all the family members affect you, have influence over your outcomes. But with a study like this, which doesn't actually look at perfect or close to really optimal lifestyles across all those variables, we called it the neuro, still you reduce the risk by 60%.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
4 years ago, there would have been an incredible hoopla saying that this is just too controversial. You're blaming people who develop it. It's not about blame. It's about control.
Mm-hmm.
So this paper was absolutely amazing, and it was highlighted over and over throughout the media.
And if you guys are interested in having access to these abstracts, we will make sure that they're available on Facebook and on our website. So one of the things that I forgot to mention was that they also looked at this risk across gender and race. So they looked at it in men and women, and they looked at African Americans, and the effect was essentially the same, which is incredible. So this really shows the importance of adhering to lifestyle factors. But one of the things that is highlighted is the fact that the more you do it, the lower your risk will be.
Correct.
So, you know, some of us can adhere to one lifestyle risk factor, but if you look at it in a very comprehensive model and in a multifaceted way, your risk will go down significantly. That's amazing. And I'm so excited about this paper.
And the only way you can do that is if you change your household.
Right. Exactly.
You can't affect all those variables if it's not part of your everyday life.
Well, from a behavioral modification standpoint, they say change your environment and healthy habits will start kicking in.
Correct.
In a very superficial way, kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing, you know, get rid of all the unhealthy lifestyle factors from around you and surround yourself with health.
Or insight in mind.
Insight in mind. I like
correct,
that. Yes.
Correct.
Okay. I think we should move on to the second paper or the second abstract. So the second abstract is titled Trajectories of Lifestyle Factors from Midlife Through Late Life and Subsequent Cognitive Decline in Women. And this is from the Nurses' Health Study. And Dr. Francine Grotstein, who is the PI of the Nurses' Health Study, is very interested in looking at cognitive decline patterns in women. And I'm really excited that she published this.
And the background in this is that women are at much higher risk of developing dementia in their life.
Right.
As much as twice as – so throughout their life – 1 in 6 women develop dementia and 1 in 11. And
right.
those numbers vary from the study to study, but there's no question that women are much higher risk. And that's even when you take survival bias into this, meaning that because women live longer, slightly longer, you would think that therefore they will have greater risk. No, even if you take that into consideration, women still have significantly higher risk of dementia. And now we haven't figured out the true variables, all the components that go into this greater risk, but we know that there is greater risk. We have some idea of those things, and the two of us have actually worked on that as well, and hoping to come up with a paper fairly soon, a research project on this.
Right, absolutely. So they were interested in looking at, obviously, healthy lifestyle and how it lowers risk of cognitive decline and dementia in women. But because there have been inconsistencies in the literature on the age range at which lifestyle factors impact cognitive aging, they wanted to find out trajectories of lifestyle factors. And they wanted to look at the effect of lifestyle specifically from midlife through late life in women subsequent cognitive decline in this incredibly large population, the Nurses' Health Study. So what they did was they did a nested case control. So they looked at cases which were about 1,500 people and then controls which were close to about 7,500 individuals. And they found they wanted to look at the effect of things like BMI, dietary pattern, and physical activity between these cases and controls. And so they essentially found out that women who were subsequently riddled with Alzheimer's disease and they had cognitive decline, they had a higher BMI. So they had
body mass index.
They were less physically active, and they had a worse dietary pattern. Right. They looked at Mediterranean dietary scores, which is essentially plant slant.
Correct.
It's mostly vegetables. It's mostly fruits and whole grains. And so this was incredible because they found out that people who had cognitive decline had actually poor lifestyle factors. And their conclusion was that women who had greater cognitive decline had worse body mass index, they had poor diet, lower physical activity in their midlife.
So the midlife component you're going to hear over and over again, especially not just today, but as we speak about this concept, it seems to be a very important stage of life that determines risk later on. Now, that might be because we're seeing some changes that we can measure. And the two of us, we actually say that your risk actually accumulates from birth on. In fact, now there's a question of what happens to you in the first few years of life might have significant effect later in life.
Yeah.
But as it stands, what we look at most often is midlife.
Yeah.
Because that's when blood pressure develops, that's when cholesterol develops, and all of these things. And we can measure some factors, right? So up to now, and in other papers you'll see, the relationship between midlife, what happened to you in midlife, and later cognitive decline was significant.
Right.
And in this case, they looked at body mass index and obesity, and then the outcome was a dementia, and in women it was significant.
It was significant. So what stood out for me was the fact that even decades prior to manifestation of dementia and cognitive decline, people tended to have these small little signs and symptoms that would push them over, that would develop into cognitive decline and dementia later in life. And then also one of the things that they pointed out was that usually this pattern of papers coming out saying that higher BMI seems to be protective later in life. There's some papers and some research that say that if women and men tend to have higher BMI later in life, that's protective. But this paper actually suggests that these studies actually focus on the later stages of dementia, and maybe this is reverse causation.
Yeah, meaning that the reason that they're surviving and also they have higher BMI is because they are survivors.
Right.
There are the few that have survived. The larger percentage of them have not survived.
Yeah.
So then it's a survival bias kind of a thing.
Exactly.
So, but in general, the consistent factor that's shown over and over again is that midlife BMI does not have a protective factor.
Absolutely.
When you take all the other factors into consideration.
Again, moving to lifestyle. Okay, let's take a look at the third paper. The title of the third abstract is Lifestyle and Cardiovascular Risk Factor Clusters and Cognitive Decline. And this was published by scientists in Australia, Randwick, Australia. So they're hypothesis was, again, they were looking at modifiable risk factors for cognitive decline. And, because the literature has typically focused on the relationship between individual risk factors and later cognitive outcomes, we know that these risk factors can co-occur. So you don't necessarily have only high blood pressure. A lot of people have high blood pressure and diabetes. And they wanted to examine the impact of this risk factors together as a cluster
yes.
on cognitive function. And they looked at multiple cohorts in this study.
Or groups.
Or groups, exactly. And so what they found out was that really there was no robust relationship between a priori defined modifiable risk factor clusters and cognitive decline. So when these risk factors are combined together, they actually have an exponential decremental effect on the brain rather than individual risk factors.
Correct. Now, when you talk about modifiable and non-modifiable, that concept has changed a little bit. Modifiable means that non-modifiable, let's start with that, means that these are things that you can't do anything about. The parents, your parents, you can't change your parents. You can't change your genetics. But modifiable ones are things like blood pressure, cholesterol, body mass index, and glucose and insulin resistance and these kind of things. In reality, there's less emphasis now on non-modifiables, mm-hmm. like genetics and everything else.
Or at least there was.
There was, correct.
Yes.
Now we know, and this paper actually corroborates, that each of those modifiable factors add to your risk of dementia and cognitive decline. But together, they add exponentially.
Correct.
And we kind of had a sense of that. Actually, recently we had a sense of that, but now this is a confirmatory. And there are more papers coming out that confirm that fact. So if you have diabetes, and you have cholesterol, high cholesterol, and you have high blood pressure, your risk is quite high. And we see this in our clinics
right.
every day.
Right.
When we have to pay. It's almost like as if when there is a dementia patient that comes to us later in life, they usually have several of these factors, the blood pressure, cholesterol, and everything put together.
Absolutely. Okay, the next abstract is, the title is Genetic Risk, Lifestyle, and Dementia. And this is probably one of my favorite abstracts out there. And this is from the Alan Turing Institute from London, United Kingdom.
This is your favorite abstract?
It actually is. It's really interesting. Just hold your breath. Listen
yes.
to it. It's really, really interesting. By the way,
this is how Aisha works. For my birthday, she gave me an abstract. No, I'm just kidding. No.
We all gave you a gift, Dean.
I'm joking.
Maybe we talked about an abstract here and there. I know that thrills you, doesn't it? Okay. So what they did was, they wanted to look at the effect of genetics. They wanted to look at the effect of genetics as well as lifestyle and the differentiation between the two of how it, pushes one over to develop dementia. And so they looked at a very large population. A combined lifestyle factor was in about 157,369 individuals, ages 60 and above. And so they identified about 666 people who had dementia over a median follow-up year of 6. So 6 years. They followed them for, 6 years. And they found out that people who had high genetic risk had 60% higher risk of developing dementia. So only genetics raised their risk by 60%. But listen to this. And they always compared that to people with lower genetic risk. But participants who had a high genetic risk, but on top of it had an unfavorable lifestyle, were more than 3 times more likely to develop dementia mm-hmm. compared to those who had a low genetic risk and favorable lifestyle. So that's incredible. They had 3 times more developing dementia
Correct.
If it was compounded by unhealthy lifestyle. And the genetic risk factors didn't really significantly modify the relationship between healthy lifestyle index and dementia risk. And so the conclusion was that genetic and lifestyle factors are strongly and independently associated with dementia, but their findings suggest that if you adhere to a healthy lifestyle, you can actually offset the genetic risk and support giving an environment for your brain to thrive, not just, stave off disease,
Correct.
And you can actually live a long and a healthy life.
Now, the genetic picture is becoming clearer and clearer. With methods such as GWAS, which is genome-wide analysis, and other methods, we know what genetic components have increased one's risk. Now we have more than 25 genes that are involved. 3 genes drive the disease
right.
extensively, meaning right. that if you have these three genes, you're going to get the disease. Mm-hmm. And even actually, even in those, we now know, and we're involved in one study, that even in those patients, you can actually push back the disease.
Right.
But the other 97%, we said 90%, but actually 97%, 95 to 97% are polygenetic. Multiple genes are involved. And these genes are not Alzheimer's genes.
Right.
They're life influencer genes. Mm-hmm. The most common one that everybody's heard about, and the one that has a little bit more influence than as far as risk is APOE4.
Yes.
So if you have one gene for APOE4, your risk goes up 4 times, and if you have two, your risk goes up, you know, as much as 12 to 20 times. And then there are other genes that have to do with your body's response to inflammation, your body's response to excess waste and waste disposal. All these are body's response to what you've done in life.
Right.
Or what has happened to you in life. So given that, the genes determine, you know, a risk factor, but not so much. It is not determinant.
Mm-hmm.
That means
mm-hmm.
that if you have these genes, doesn't mean that you're going to get it. And now this paper, and there have been others as well,
right.
shows how much influence lifestyle has over genetics. In fact, how much lifestyle trumps genetics in this case.
Yeah, absolutely. And this paper essentially confirms what we've known for a long time now. And this is a replication of the studies that were done in the Framingham Heart and longitudinal study in the Columbia University also conducted a study looking at different populations and their genetic risk with dementia. So, you know, when you get the same results over and over again, it's a confirmation of the fact that lifestyle trumps genes.
Correct.
When it comes to cognitive decline, which is amazing.
I don't know who said it. The lifestyle genes load the gun and lifestyle pulls the trigger.
I think it was Dr. Esselstyn,
wasn't
he?
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was his.
Dr. Esselstyn, you just got credit for that beautiful quote.
Thank you for the beautiful quote, Dr. Esselstyn. Yeah. Okay, moving on to the fifth paper, the fifth abstract. The title is High Lifespan Cognitive Reserve is Associated with a Reduced Dementia Risk Independently of Brain Pathologies.
Before
cognitive reserve.
Can I start? Oh, this
Please
is my favorite it. Subject. This is my area of interest. I get so excited about this. So cognitive reserve is your bank account.
Yeah.
You know, how much you have in that bank account determines how much you can buy, how much stress your life can go through,
right.
and still have reserve. You have brain reserve. I mean, these are somewhat arbitrary terms, but they represent what they represent very well. Brain reserve is the brain capacity that you're left with after a certain age early on in life as a consequence of your environment early life and genetics as well.
Mm-hmm.
That brain reserve is the architecture of the brain, as well as the connectivity and how, you know, how the nutrients you received and the environmental information and all of these things created that infrastructure. That's what you're going to be left with for the rest of your life.
Right.
Cognitive reserve is what you develop over time, the connectivity. Now, we have about 87 billion neurons. Each of the neurons, and this is simplified, but many areas of the brain, many of the neurons can make a few connections or as many as 30,000 connections. That connectivity is dependent on amount of stimulus, amount of information, challenge, and much more. And we've done many sessions on that. That connectivity is profound protection.
Yeah.
If 2 billion of your neurons make a couple of connections, or because you've lived a very challenging and pleasant and pleasing and vibrant life, you are a conductor of the LA Philharmonic. I'm saying that so maybe we can get some free tickets from LA Philharmonic. And your brain is being challenged. Then each of those 2 billion are making thousands of connections.
Right.
Those thousands of connections are power.
Mm-hmm.
Though that's your reserve. That's beyond reserve. That's your brain power.
Yes.
When people compare the brain to a muscle, it's such a disservice to the brain. The brain is 30,000 or at least 20,000 times more powerful than any muscle can
be. It
really is. Even as far as connectivity and growth is concerned.
Yes.
This paper actually speaks to that. So I that was a little excited about that concept, so I'll let you go over the paper.
I love it. No, I think this is really interesting because for a long time, cognitive reserve was really not understood very well. And this paper actually confirmed some of the other findings from different studies. So this was also, well, actually, this was a combination of or a collaboration between Karolinska Institute in Sweden,
yes,
and the Rush University from Chicago. So they looked at individuals within the Rush Memory and Aging Project. They looked at 1,638 dementia-free older adults. Mean age was 79 years mm-hmm. of age. They were followed for about 20 years, and the outcomes or thing that they wanted to focus was incident dementia. So they wanted to find out who developed dementia. And information on their cognitive reserve was obtained. So they basically looked at how long they went to school, what their education was, what kind of degrees did they get, and what kind of cognitive activities were they involved in during early, mid, and late life. And they also asked them about their social activities. Correct. Engagement with people. And then they were followed. So during the follow-up period, you know, a lot of them passed away, and they underwent neuropathological evaluations for Alzheimer's disease. So they had autopsies of their brains, and their brain pathologies was looked at. And what was found that people who engaged in social events, they had a social life, and they had the highest cognitive reserve, which was a combination or composite score of all of these mm-hmm. factors, were at a lower risk of dementia. So they actually had lower pathologies.
Correct.
Or even if they had burden of Alzheimer's disease pathologies, they really didn't manifest it during lifetime.
Meaning, sorry, it sure. means that even if they had pathology, I mean the disease, the lesions, the amyloid and the plaque, and even the vascular disease, even with that, with those lesions in place, they were protected because of the reserve.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. It both reduced the risk as well as protected you against the risk. That's where cognitive reserve becomes so powerful.
Yeah.
And cognitive reserve is in your hand at any age. In fact, although we don't grow new neurons that much, I mean,
right.
there was a time we said no new neurons, but we now know that we do. But that's nominal. That's not going to be that significant at this point. What we do have control over is the connectivity.
Right.
And that connectivity comes as a result of not just playing Sudoku or crossword puzzles, although those are good, those are fine, but much more complex behavior.
I think
behavior.
By now everybody knows you don't like Sudoku.
I hate Sudoku. It's much more complex behavior.
Right.
In fact, something as simple yet complex as social activity.
Right.
Social activity is challenging to the brain. Music, learning a new musical instrument, not just listening, not just reading, but reciting, rewriting, or writing a book or writing papers, learning how to dance. For some of us, it's extremely challenging. We won't say who. But so that kind of activity creates tremendous reserve.
Absolutely.
And connectivity.
Right. So, higher cognitive reserve actually was very beneficial. But one of the other things that I forgot to mention was that in people who had genetic risk factors, specifically APOE4 carriers, the risk reduction with high cognitive reserve was greatest in the carriers.
That's
so
amazing.
Meaning that even if you have a very strong genetic risk factor, cognitive reserve actually had the greatest protective effect on the brain, which is amazing. And we see that pattern. We see that pattern that
yeah.
even if you have APOE4 or other genetics for it, if you live a healthy life, if you keep your mind active, you're really going to be protected.
The nun study showed this.
Yes.
The same kind of thing. I think Rush was involved in that as well.
Yes.
And where nuns who had profound pathology of Alzheimer's and dementia, yet during life they were protected.
Right.
And others who didn't have that much pathology, yet they had Alzheimer's. Then the difference was cognitive reserve,
right.
Elements that tell you of cognitive reserve. So the lesson there: get out there, get involved, get social, get mentally active, challenge yourself around your passions, and that will protect you more than anything you will see on TV. In fact, there's nothing that will protect you against brain diseases on TV. No vitamins, no pills, no blue jellyfish elements.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the other abstract, the sixth abstract. The title is High Lifespan Cognitive Reserve Reduces the Risk of Mild Cognitive Impairment to and decelerates its progression to dementia. So this is based on the same cohort.
Correct.
And in the same population. And they found out that people who had high cognitive reserve, it reduced the risk of mild cognitive impairment among cognitive intact people. And also, if they ever developed mild cognitive impairment, the progression from MCI to dementia was slowed down by almost 4 years.
So MCI is mild cognitive impairment. That's a pre-dementia stage. And not everybody who develops MCI develops dementia, but more than 50% do. Now, we think that even that 50% that's at risk can be affected, even right pre-dementia stage.
Right.
Now, the importance of this is that delaying from MCI to dementia, even when they took all of the population by 4 years, even those that are at risk, at the edge of dementia, they were pushed back by 4 years.
Amazing.
By just cognitive reserve.
Can you remind us about that statistic where, you know, delaying it by a certain number of years, the cost of dementia was cut by half?
Yeah, by 5 years.
Wow.
By five, so the costliest disease in the healthcare system is Alzheimer's. The second costliest disease is heart disease, which $120 billion or so. Third is cancers, altogether $70 billion or so. Dementia by itself is $279 billion direct, another $240 billion indirect.
Amazing.
On its way to becoming $1.1 to $1.3 trillion by 2040, 2050.
Yeah.
That's going to overwhelm our system. If we can just push dementia back by 5 years, we'll have reduced the cost by half. Now, as you read earlier, as you heard earlier, just the five elements, if you adhere to four of them somewhat well, you reduce the risk by 60%. Here, just cognitive reserve pushed it back by 4 years.
Yeah.
What if you can do all of it, all of the lifestyle factors, which we talk about in neuro, nutrition, exercise, unwind, which is stress reduction and stress management, and sleep or restorative sleep and mental activity or optimizing mental, if we can do all of them well, the disease will be pushed significantly back, and the cost to healthcare system in general will be, I mean, significantly reduced. What does that mean? It's not just a financial thing.
Mm.
We see the outcome in the families, how it destroys families, it tears families apart, especially that since we don't have good support structure around this horrible disease. So cognitive reserve is extremely important. It's in your control, and it's what you do every day, several hours a day, that challenge your brain around your passions.
Absolutely. Beautiful. Okay, let's move on to the other abstract. So this is the seventh one. The compensatory role of physical activity on the association between cardiometabolic syndrome and dementia. This was incredible.
Yeah.
So this is from University College of London, UK. And they wanted to find out if people who are not really doing well as far as their cardiometabolic syndrome is concerned. So, you know, as far as these five symptoms. So, metabolic syndrome is a combination. It has a diagnostic criteria that is based on five symptoms: high blood pressure, blood sugar, serum, triglycerides, cholesterol, and
obesity.
Abdominal obesity. So, you know, so metabolic syndrome consists of these five. And they wanted to find out the role of exercise when someone has metabolic syndrome and how it affects their cognition later on in life. So they looked at 401 new cases of dementia in their population. And they wanted to specify people who had metabolic syndrome. And they found out that these people, exercised to a certain extent, and they wanted to find out how much. So they looked at the relationship, and they found out that there was a significant association between high physical activity and dementia incidence, suggesting that a decreased risk of dementia for those who were physically active, but not for those with metabolic syndrome. So their conclusion was that high level of physical activity actually influenced the neurophysiological cascade of changes occurring in the preclinical phases, and it averted dementia. So the people who had, you know, various levels of metabolic syndrome, if they exercised, their risk of dementia was averted during the different stages.
Correct. Although the relationship, this paper was a little unusual in the sense that metabolic syndrome itself was not affected, but that then indirectly cognition was affected.
Yeah.
So that's right. But we've seen other kind of papers that show actually even metabolic syndrome is significantly affected, and cognition is definitely affected. But physical activity has profound effect on brain pathology or absence of brain pathology.
In spite of metabolic syndrome and other lifestyle factors.
Correct.
So it almost acts like a buffer, like a protective layer for the brain and for cognition in general.
What you'll see is, and we've spoken about this, that one element can protect you against another bad element.
Yeah.
So to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And then after a while, that one bad element, if it gets bad enough, it will overwhelm even your reserves.
Right.
And we talk about this, that our grandparents, both of them, brilliant men, so they had the cognitive reserve, significant cognitive reserve, but yet diet and activity was zero.
Right.
I mean, you could give them a zero score, yet they both succumbed to dementia. And most of it was was a vascular kind of a metabolic kind of a picture in this. And we see this often. But to a certain extent, this one element will try to hold off the wavefront of damage, of wavefront of dementia.
Right.
As much as it can.
Yeah.
And then after a while, it gets overwhelmed. Physical activity in this paper seems to play that role. And in fact, all of them do. You know, if you have cognitive reserve, as we saw there, it can withstand the wavefront of all the other damage that you do to your body.
I think that's been the general theme
Correct.
Of all the lifestyle papers that were put out there. I mean, and that's what the data shows.
Correct. And what if you can actually affect all of them? Then you don't have a negative wavefront, and you don't have to protect, and you can just grow. And that's another thing we want to talk about. You can actually grow cognitive capacity at any age,
mm-hmm.
but it's important that you start early enough across all these factors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about the eighth one, the eighth abstract, sleep. I know that everybody's interested in this topic, and sleep was discussed a lot this year. So we all know that people who don't sleep well, or if they have abnormal sleep duration, which, by the way, for adults is anything less than 7 hours or anything more than 9 hours nightly,
Correct.
Has been associated with cognitive dysfunction. And this paper looked at sleep duration, nighttime dipping patterns, dipping in blood pressure essentially, and cognitive function in adult children with a parental history of Alzheimer's disease. So they wanted to look at sleep patterns, and during sleep, blood pressure should dip between 10 to 20%. And this dipping patterns outside of this norm has been associated with dementia and poor cognition. And they wanted to examine the potential association between sleep duration and this dipping pattern and cognitive test performance in people who had a family history of Alzheimer's disease, either their mom or dad had Alzheimer's disease. And so they found out that sleep duration and this nighttime dipping pattern was related to specific cognitive functions and domains, like verbal memory,
mm-hmm.
so that if they slept poorly, they actually had impaired verbal memory, which, can you give us an example of what that means?
So there are different components of memory, short-term and long-term. Of course, that's one delineation. And then within short-term memory, there's several. There's verbal, there's visual, there's procedural. So it's the procedural one is when you can do multiple steps and remember how to do multiple steps, and verbal, by definition, everybody knows what that means. And visual is objects, faces, and things of that nature.
Yeah, absolutely. So they also found out that people who had abnormal nighttime dipping patterns, so if their blood pressure was
that sounds
dipping
more terrible than it probably is. Nighttime dipping.
Yeah.
Yes.
If they dipped too much or they dipped too little, they had cognitive decline. So if it was less than 10% or greater than 20%, it was associated with cognitive impairment. And this is very important. It's very important for people, especially for those who have risk factors for sleep apnea, say, for example, if they have a short neck, mm-hmm. or if they have some redundant tissue, or if they've been checked and they have some dental problems, they have to address it early in life. And doctors, you know, primary care physicians should actually talk to their patients about, you know, changes in their blood pressure during their midlife and finding out whether they have proclivity for sleep apnea. You and I see that all the time in our clinic.
We've been saying this, and we're going to say it again and again and again, and now it's coming out that sleep is where you should invest the most in your house. Yeah, people spend money going to these retreats and amazing trips around health. Put that money in your bedroom.
Right.
Fix your bedroom. Sound, light, temperature. You know, learn about cognitive behavioral therapy. All these things that actually give you deep sleep. And it's not just about sleep apnea.
Right.
Where oxygen is not getting to the brain.
True.
We now know that even if you're getting sleep, but it's not deep sleep, and you're not achieving those wave patterns necessary to allow for brain to memorize, recall, so that's one of the two purposes of sleep.
Right.
One is memory consolidation, and it requires certain wave patterns, as well as cleansing, but that requires perfect or deeper levels of sleep to be achieved for several times a night. And as it happens, that's the most common thing we see,
right,
is poor sleep.
Absolutely.
And what's the answer for poor sleep?
Sleeping pills, unfortunately.
What's the answer for any disease?
Pills. Yeah.
And we're not against pills.
Yeah, which are important in certain situations.
Yeah, if you had a stroke, if you had heart disease, if you have high cholesterol, yes, cholesterol medication for short term until lifestyle takes over, blood pressure medication, but that's not the final answer.
Right.
So invest in your sleep. Sleep is where you actually rebuild your brain.
Right. So definitely more than 7 hours, not more than 9 hours of sleep is absolutely crucial.
Not more than 9 hours is indicative of the fact that there's something wrong, and that's why you're sleeping. You need more sleep because you're not getting deeper sleep.
Right.
That's the theory behind it.
Right.
Why would you need 9 hours? Why would you need 12 hours unless there's some kind of pathology in the body or in sleep pattern that's telling the body that you're not getting restorative sleep?
Yeah.
So if you are what they call hypersomnia,
yeah,
too much sleep, or you're getting 8 hours sleep and you're still sleepy, absolutely see a sleep specialist, because there's probably something wrong that's causing the sleep disorder.
Absolutely. Beautiful, beautiful paper. Okay, let's move on to the ninth one, the ninth abstract. And this was incredibly interesting. So the title is Associations Between Sociodemographic and Lifestyle Factors with Loneliness, The Role of Meaning in Life. When was the last time you remember something like this being presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference?
It's
so refreshing to see that scientists are looking at the bigger picture.
And this is not soft science. We're all about hard science. We're all about things that have measurable parameters. I hate it when people throw a term that has not been well delineated, and then people make huge extrapolations from that soft definition, and all of a sudden you see it on a magazine that, you know, weird concept is the cause of a greater mortality or disease. But, you know, this is not a soft term. The concept of purpose and meaning is can be delineated, can be measurable. You can't put metrics and measurements around it. And as it happens over and over and over again, whether be it in those communities where they're vital and they're living better and longer, such as blue zones, or in the communities where they're not so vital, and it's the opposite of the spectrum, purpose and meaning and connectivity seems to have the greatest influence on outcome and disease.
Beautiful. Okay. So this is from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston. And they wanted to look at, obviously, the effect of loneliness on cognitive health. It has been established that loneliness is associated with negative cardiovascular and mental health outcomes in general. So they studied 1,622 individuals who were healthy. These were individuals between the ages of 40 to 65. And they were a part of a larger study called the Barcelona Brain Health Initiative. And they studied their family structure, found out, you know, how long they had been living alone. They looked at their income and some other various lifestyle factors, their cognitive activity, physical activity. And they wanted to adjust for all of these confounders, which is, you know, quality of sleep, the type of food they ate, whether they exercise or not. And they found that the people who were lonely, they actually had a poor cognitive status and a higher risk for developing a cognitive impairment later on in life. And they were also tested and to find out, they were also tested for different kinds of psychiatric illnesses to find out, you know, if those were confounders. And most of these associations were mediated by anxiety and depression. And people who had high ratings as far as meaning in life is concerned, so they had qualitative questionnaires to ask them, you know, whether they had purpose or meaning in life. They actually had the best quality of life, and they had lower risk of having diseases in general.
Dementia, cognitive decline,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So, loneliness, or the other side of it is social and connectivity, are extremely important, profoundly important, and that's something that we're seeing is affecting a huge number of the elderly population in the Western world, and it must be addressed, because that by itself affects everything, be it directly through how they respond to diseases and how their immune system is affected and everything else. And so therefore they are much higher risk of infections, much higher risk of cognitive decline and dementia, or indirectly through depression and anxiety and all these other factors, where they affect their will to live and their compliance with medication, compliance with healthcare, compliance with lifestyle factors. So loneliness is a big public health factor.
It is. It definitely
is. Which is not being approached as a public health factor, given that the fastest growing population in America is 65 and above, and actually in the Western world.
Yeah.
And loneliness seems to be a very, very important factor contributing to all chronic disease, but especially cognitive decline. I think it should be included in a strategic plan at the national level as far as what to do as far as loneliness is concerned. How to create connectivity, how to create social environments where people can actually connect with others in a safe safe way, where they can even maintain the cognitive reserve, as well as then have those networks that help them with their healthcare, with everything else. So loneliness, we think, should be addressed as a major public health emergency.
And a lot of people, they prefer to live alone. One of the things that was discussed in this abstract was also the fact that even if people lived alone, their perception of loneliness, or that perception of not being connected, was much lower when they had a purpose and a meaning in life.
Yeah.
When they had a vector that they were working towards.
Correct.
So that was very interesting. Okay. We're going to go over one more abstract, the last one. There's so many other ones too. I think we should actually have another session for that one.
Correct. And there's one other behind this last one that we were going to share. So maybe two abstracts.
Okay, we'll go ahead and do the two one. This one. Okay. The tenth one is, the title is, Physical Activity Mediates the Effect of Depressive Symptoms on Cognitive Decline. And this is from St. Louis University. And this study was conducted in a large population, looking at the Health and Retirement Survey. It actually includes about close to 10,000 individuals that have been followed for a long, long time. And these individuals went through a cognitive testing called the Telephone Interview for Cognitive Study. And essentially, they wanted to look at how physical activity mediated the effect of depressive symptoms among people who actually had depression. And their conclusion was that physical activity potentially improved the cognitive function of older individuals who already had depressive symptoms. And moderate and mild physical activity benefited older individuals with these symptoms and reduced their risk of developing cognitive decline. And older individuals who were frail, who had physical disability or some chronic medical condition, they were less likely to participate in vigorous physical activity. But even so, you know, engagement in mild to moderate activity in the context of a social environment actually benefited them quite a lot.
So we keep saying that nutrition is the most important thing, or mental activity and social activity is the most important thing. All of those are the most important things. I mean,
right.
That sounds paradoxical that
right.
all of it could be. But I'll tell you, physical activity is also the most important thing.
Right.
I mean, as far as resilience and anti-frailty, I just created that term, anti-frailty,
yeah.
There's nothing like physical activity.
Absolutely.
There's a Columbia University study that came out that the most important factor that determined frailty or absence of frailty and better health long-term was physical activity.
Yeah.
Lack of, you know, reduction of number of falls, broken bones, ability to move. That's one element.
Mood. Yeah.
And then its effect on cognition.
Right.
You know,
it's
there are several studies from Harvard and other places that as much as 45% reduction in dementia just from physical activity. And it's the way it works is greater blood flow and more importantly, BDNF and these, you know, brain-derived or neurotrophic factors.
Yeah.
As well as connectivity of neurons.
Right.
I mean, we always say that nutrition and stress management and sleep help create the environment and cleanse the environment for brain to grow. And exercise and mental activity and social activity actually do the growing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's critical that we focus on exercise significantly. Here's where the rub is. Whenever we talk to patients and say, you know, are you exercising? Oh, yes, Dr. Sherzad, I'm fine. I move around all day. You know, I walk the neighborhood. I do some gardening. I do that. I say, oh, that's great. That's meditation. Exercise means really significant exercise. And it doesn't mean that you have to get there tomorrow. Create a slow progression of successes so that you get there over 6 months. But where there is... it's about 25 minutes to 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, 4 to 5 days a week of strenuous exercise where you actually get tired. You're short of breath. And, of course, with your doctor's approval, make sure you get a doctor's approval. And that's critical. And the as far as anaerobic, muscle building, legs are critically important because it's going to reduce your fall risk. It increases blood flow to the brain. So start an exercise program. And today, if you haven't been exercising, 5 minutes of brisk walk. Even if you can do 10 minutes, no. And then slowly over time, build that by 1 minute at a time. Exercise is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And studies on exercise and depression.
Right.
There was no drug that actually was more effective than exercise for depression and anxiety. Okay.
Wonderful. Okay, let's go over the last one, the last paper, the 11th one. Higher education provides resilience against deteriorative effects of higher middle age body mass index on old age cognitive function. Okay, so this study was done in Finland, and they wanted to look at middle age body mass index and education and find out, you know, what is the relationship between the two and how it can prevent cognitive impairment and dementia.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I keep seeing is
interactions.
Yeah, interaction of different lifestyle risk factors, and also looking at it, you know, decades before dementia and Alzheimer's have been, you know, typically looked at.
Correct.
Everybody starts, in most papers, remember 5 years ago, everybody would use the cutoff of 65 and above, but now we're looking at ages 30, 40, 50, and that seems to be the most important age group as far as accumulation of damage is concerned.
Correct. Well, like I said earlier, it's not actually not 30-year-olds. 30-year-olds still think they're immortal, and 20-year-olds completely immortal.
Well, yeah.
It's 40s and 50s,
right.
And two reasons. One is it's at that age that they start getting glimpses into blood pressure and glimpses into cholesterol, and they get a sense of mortality, so they're more aware, alert, and responsive. The other thing is you see the signs.
Yeah.
So that's why it's important. As it happens, that's because you can see the signs or indirect signs such as blood pressure, cholesterol, and all of these things, you can affect it. And the time period from middle age to later life is not that far, so you can see the effect sooner.
Right.
But reality is the sooner you start, the better. But who's going to convince a 20-year-old to go completely whole food plant-based? I hope we can convince a lot of people. And it should be convincing because it's at 20 years or so that the cognitive decline starts. And if you start the nutrition and lifestyle and everything else early enough, you don't go towards decline. You actually have improvement in cognition and attention and memory and executive function and all of these things.
Yeah.
So if we can do anything is, yeah, for now, we'll focus on midlife. You and I have been talking about midlife for a while. But what we're saying now is it's not even midlife. It's earlier than that. At midlife you start, you'll gain the benefits. You'll see the benefits. But the process starts earlier. Involve your children. In fact, we start with children, educating them, because the public health direction is much better from bottom up than up down.
You bet.
So it's critical to involve younger people and younger people in
as much as possible
on lifestyle and brain health, lifestyle and health. That's where we can do have the most impact. It's lovely to see all these papers, and we just scratched the surface.
Yeah. Oh,
there are so many other papers coming out.
Right.
And we are so glad to have been the leaders. I'm going to take that leadership. We're going to take that leadership mantle years ago. And we're going to say here, a few years ago was 30% influence of lifestyle on cognition. Then it was 40%. This year was 60%. And we have said 80 to 90%.
Right.
And they'll catch up with us.
Right.
But what we say is if you started comprehensively, massively, and early enough,
mm-hmm.
you can do that. So I hope that everybody takes this seriously.
Right. So this paper, we kind of just injected that concept in here because it's so interesting. But so this paper, as the title suggested, they wanted to look at what cognitive reserve did to the brain if someone had a high BMI during midlife.
Yes.
So say, for example, if somebody was, you know, heavier, if they had higher or lower education, what did that do to their risk of dementia? And their results showed that the effect of middle-age BMI on old-age cognition, of whether they developed dementia or not, was moderated by level of education, such that if they had higher education but they had high BMI, they were protected.
Correct. More protected.
More protected,
so,
compared
yeah.
to those who had high BMI and lower education.
Correct.
Which is amazing.
It is.
Points to the concept of
cognitive reserve
and this amazing protective effect of keeping your mind active throughout life.
And there's a little bit of factor of the fact that if they're higher educated, they're more also more aware of how to handle those, you know, heavier weight and all the other factors such as blood pressure, cholesterol, and everything else. So they manage it better. But even beyond that, there seems to be a protective factor that comes from cognitive reserve, which
exactly.
is amazing.
Which, you know, and this actually is really helpful for people who already have mild cognitive impairment and they're kind of moving towards dementia. One of the most common questions that we get is, okay, so your book is about, you know, prevention and living a healthy life during your midlife. What about people who already have symptoms of cognitive impairment? Although this looked at midlife where people didn't have any cognitive impairment, but the theory is it's never too late to start living a healthy life.
Correct.
And especially when it comes to combination of different lifestyle factors, especially cognitive resilience and reserve, you know, keeping one's mind active and engaging in an activity that builds those connection is important and can be beneficial even in later stages of life.
Correct.
Beautiful. Okay. So with that, we will end this rather long session. Thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us. We are so excited that, you know, larger organizations like the Alzheimer's Association have also come on board as far as the importance of lifestyle is concerned. I can't tell you how happy we are. We've been saying this for over 14 years, and now finally we know that it's more than just one bad protein or one specific molecule or a process, that it's a very complex disease, and it has to be addressed in a complex way, and it has to be addressed early, because the pathological processes start 10 to 20 years before the manifestation of any physical signs and symptoms. So for all my dear friends out there who are in their 30s, their 40s, and their 50s, start right now, because you would want to live a cognitively vibrant life in your 60s, 70s, and 80s.
And beyond.
And beyond. And with that, we bid you well. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you soon then. Take care.
Thank you.